Near FM.
Jonathan Whiff said, "It is useless to attempt to reason a man out of the thing he was never reasoned into." Welcome to International Politics 90.3. This is Near FM, and you're very welcome to International Politics on the first time ever we've been going on Friday evenings, and it's this Friday evening and every second Friday afterwards. I'm Peter Carney, and I'm with you from 6 to 7, as I said, every Friday fortnight. Significant happenings on this day, the 30th of August, that's significant in the world of politics. In 1918, Fanny Kaplan shoots and seriously injures Vladimir Lenin. And in 1999, East Timor voted for independence from Indonesia in a referendum. Significant births on this day. Well, I couldn't really find too many, very, very few indeed, of political significance. Just one, and that was in 1821. It was Anita Garibaldi, who was the Brazilian wife of Giuseppe Garibaldi. So happy birthday, happy remembrance to her and others. So in this fortnight show, some good stuff lined up for you as before. We're going to Australia, South Africa and Egypt. First up to Australia, I'm going to be talking about Visa 457, and I interviewed Irishman Dean Keating, who's living in Australia, about the impacts and the changes of Visa 457 to Visa 457 holders in Australia, and in particular in Western Australia. So something that may be of interest to people who are currently applying for that visa. South Africa, it's slightly different to what we usually cover in politics. It's an interview I conducted with Matthew Brown with his article on Vice.com on drug police in Cape Town. So he followed them for a night and he was with them undercover for a night. So a little bit about that. And Egypt, as it is still in the news, and it was in the news, it's been in the news for many weeks now. A couple of weeks back, there were protests outside the embassy, the Egyptian embassy in Dublin. And indeed, the night before, there were some protests in the city centre going up to the mosque in Clonskee, and indeed protests since that time have been ongoing. So I recorded some interviews on the day, and as well as that, in keeping with the radio documentary that I'm making about Muslims in Ireland, I interviewed Dr. Vincent Jurek from UCD, who had something to say about the Arab Spring, and in particular implications that had for Egypt and is having at the moment. So all of that coming up this evening. If you wish to participate, you can, as always, by texting us on 087-6944-500. That's 087-6944-500. The station here, you can call on 867 1190. Or if you want to catch up with me on Facebook or Twitter or any of those places, on Facebook, just put in International Politics Dublin, or on Twitter, put in Peter's Politics and you'll find me right there. Please feel free to comment and all that kind of stuff, participate. So the Irish community stunned with proposed fees for public schools. Western Australia's government are seeking to implement a charge on 457 visa holders for public education from January 2014. The fees that are being suggested are for $4,000 Australian dollars per child per annum. The Irish community has reacted angrily, as this fee is seen as a hit at a part of the community with no voice in state government. So I caught up with Dean Keating, who's in Australia, in Perth at the moment, living there with his family. And he talks about the implications of this, because the number of people who had applied and were successful in getting this 457 visa, a visa that lasts for about 4 years in Australia, were people in Ireland who, as a result of the crisis and so on and so forth, decided to start again in Australia, or go to Australia for at least 4 years and see what things were like here. Now, if this charge comes in, and it has been budgeted to come in the Western Australian government's budget, as Dean mentioned, there was some mishandling of their budget in Western Australia, not too dissimilar to what we experienced here in Ireland. And possibly as a way of getting that back, or one of the methods of getting back some of the money, is a charge of $4,000 per child per 457 visa holder, which if you've gone down there with three kids, you know, is a considerable expense. And this is apparently a figure after tax. So indeed, the figure could be significantly higher than that if you have gone down there with a couple of children. OK, so this is the interview. So as I caught up with Dean Keating, he's one of the organisers, main organisers in Australia, in Western Australia, against this proposed charge. And this is how Dean explained it.
Seven visas, like they're visas that were made available by the federal government here in Australia to bring skilled workers in to fill gaps in the knowledge or the skill set to drive on the Australian economy. Now, in Western Australia, which is the state I'd be in, they have really taken advantage of this. You might remember yourself in 2011. They had a very aggressive approach in Ireland and the UK and other countries, where they sent over members of the business community from construction, tourism, the chambers, to recruit skilled staff. I can remember at the time in 2011, they were in the City West Hotel. They had media campaigns. They were being interviewed on RTE, etc., etc. So they really wanted Irish people to come over. So the 457 visa, usually the way that works, it'd be an employer that would sponsor you over, and it's a four-year visa. Now, it is a temporary visa, but most people that went from Ireland in particular on that visa were probably similar to myself. They went with family, kids in tow. So it's a huge move because it's not like you're a backpacker. I mean, you're open sticks from your community. You're leaving family, friends behind. You're moving your kids from their settled school into the unknown, because, like, obviously, when most people arrive here, they know nobody.
Yeah, just to clarify, 457 visa holders, they're people who would have permanently moved from Ireland or from any country to Australia to live and work there to help with the skills shortage in Australia.
Exactly. You know, the visa itself, it does have a term on it. It's a 4-year visa. But generally, they reckon about 50% of people that come over on that visa go for permanent residency.
It's a visa for people who are serious minded about moving and living in Australia on a pretty permanent basis.
Exactly. I was probably, as you know yourself, with the economy being so bad at home, it was kind of an escape route for many families, because they had no work and there was no opportunity at home. So it was a way out, and I suppose the Australian timing was very good. They were recruiting at a massive level, particularly here in Western Australia. So the volume of Irish people that came to Western Australia on that visa would be phenomenal. We actually arrived on that visa ourselves, but we're permanent residents now. But when we arrived, we were on the 457 ourselves.
And what type of workers would have gone and got the 457 visa?
It'd be a lot of professionals, and then related to the say the construction industry as well. But you can see when you meet the Irish here that arrived in the last 2 years, a very educated workforce, professionals. But then obviously the construction side of things as well. There was a huge population from back home that came from the construction side. But I'd notice it myself, even say going to say networking events or dealing with different businesses, there is a phenomenal amount of Irish professionals here as well.
And what are you doing yourself there, Dean?
Just outsourcing myself to different companies to do sales for them. My wife was she was sponsored over. Initially, she's a psychologist. She's working with the Autism Association here in Perth.
So this regulation, 457 visa holders, is a charge being brought in. It's just by the Western Australian government, is it?
Their budget was about 3 weeks ago, and in that budget, they said they're going to charge 457 visa holders $4,000 per child per annum.
Right.
So, there's families, as you can imagine, there with 3 to 5 kids. So, I mean, if taking the extreme example there, 5 kids by $4,000 is $20,000, and that's cash. That's a net figure.
That's 20,000 Australian dollars.
Exactly. I mean, that's after tax. So, I mean, realistically, that's probably in terms of earnings here, it's probably roughly, you'd say, $25,000.
Okay, so it's an after-tax figure.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Now, what's the purpose of this charge? Is it just to deter people from coming in, or is it to, or well, is there a similar charge being put on Australian citizens?
No, like what the WA government are saying is that they've had a huge explosion in the school-going population. Now, part of it is down, obviously, to increase of Australians going, because the population is growing, but they're saying that there's a huge increase in the number of foreigners going, 457 visa holders going. So they're saying it's on average it takes about $15,000 to put a child through school here, and they're saying we're going to charge $4,000 because they feel that 457 holders, they're not citizens, so they should be making a contribution.
Okay, so, and but yeah, but 457 visa holders would work there and pay tax. So they're, in many respects, indeed, probably in all respects, they're making the same financial contributions as other Australians, wouldn't they?
They are. Like, they're paying exactly the same taxes as Australian citizens, but they don't have the benefits of Australian citizens. So they've no social welfare entitlements. They've no Medicare entitlements. So whereas an Australian citizen would have those entitlements because they are citizens. So, but in fairness, like myself included, when we come over, like we knew we didn't have those entitlements, so we knew that was a downside of the visa. But like, because you're bringing kids over, I mean, you research as best you can, and probably the priorities for parents in terms of research is two things. One is health system, and the second thing is education. And the education system, it was, you were paying a nominal fee. It's about $60 per child. So you were being charged the same as an Australian citizen up to recently. Now, this budget doesn't come into effect till January of 2014. So it hasn't been passed yet, but it was brought up in the budget.
Okay, so it's a serious proposal. And it's just by the Western Australian government. It's not taking place in any other states in Australia, is it?
It's not, no. Like, there is two other states in Australia that do charge for education. But Western Australia is a bit different in terms of, they were very proactive in getting people over. And, I mean, they've kind of moved the goalposts, Peter. Like, I suppose Irish families, well, I'm dealing mainly with Irish families, but we've had a number of Scottish and English, Welsh, Filipinos contact us there over the last week. They're outraged because they physically don't have it, because there's no family tax rebate. Like, what it means is that generally the wife can't work because she's child mining, because it's not, she'd have to pay the full whack for a child miner, so it's not worth her while working. I would say 90% of 457s they've one income coming in, and it's not kind of massive money. It's average Australian salaries.
Yes.
But the perception, with some of the perception of Australian people is they think the 457s are on mega money, like they're working in the mines,
right,
and they're making huge money. The second problem from an Australian point of view, some of them would they think that these 457s are taking Australian jobs, which isn't the case, because like they were brought over to fill a gap.
Yeah.
Which Australian citizens couldn't fill.
Yeah. That's right. No. Okay. So this charge of $4,000 by the Western Australian government on the visa holders, and they say that this money is going towards health and education. That's the intended target of this money.
Yeah. Well, that's what they're saying. It's kind of gone a bit similar to Ireland in terms of, the Western Australian government's their expenditure far exceeds their tax revenue over the last couple of years, so they've mismanaged the economy here to an extent. So they need to kind of generate revenue. And the thing with 457 holders, they are a silent majority. They're a silent people here because they've no vote, they've no rights. So they are an easy target to a large extent.
Yeah. So the Western Australian government, how does it work in Australia? Is it federalised, or can the Western Australian government operate independently of the overall Australian government? Is there any intervention there on a national level?
Say on a national level, like Australia has committed to the United Nations Charter of Free Education for Children. So obviously Australia's committed to that, but the WA government, obviously they're breaking that agreement, but they can't, strangely enough, they cannot be taken to task on that matter. I haven't gone through the law completely, but my understanding of it is you'd have to take a class action against the federal government to get the free education here, okay. Which sounds strange. You would think that that the WA government would be following what the federal government are saying, as in it's free education, but obviously that's not the case.
Fantastic, and thanks very much to Dean Keating for that. So if anybody's travelling or thinking of travelling to Western Australia, you can contact Dean. It's dean.keating68@gmail.com. That's his email address. Or text me here on 087-6900-4500 and we'll pass on Dean's details to you. Okay, so next up we're going to South Africa. And as I said already at the start of the show, we're going to South Africa. They don't find much, some weed and a tick lolly. A small test tube with a glass bubble at the end, made exclusively for smoking methamphetamine or tick, as it's known in Cape Town's townships. This is how South African journalist Matthew Brown begins to explain a night undercover with Cape Town's Metro Substance Abuse Unit. That's all on Vice.com. And you can find out more about it on Cruising Through Cape Town Slums with Elite Drug Cops on Vice.com. And this is when I caught up with Matthew Brown. This is how he explained the situation a little bit more.
I think because the whole of South Africa really works a little bit differently to other places because of the history of apartheid, the drug system works a little bit differently there too. Because you had huge amounts of the population sidelined and specifically and purposefully undereducated and forced into worse, living conditions. So because the apartheid government pushed people into further away areas and purposely undereducated them and ensured that they had worse living conditions, I think the drug problem is worse than it would have been.
Okay. So what you investigated, it's still split along the lines of colour.
Yes, and in Cape Town, we a part of the population that we call coloured, which in America is an insulting term, but isn't in South Africa.
Yeah.
In Cape Town, those are the people who've been marginalised as well. So in Johannesburg, the low-end drug users and dealers are mostly black because of those circumstances, and in Cape Town, they're mostly what we call coloured.
What is coloured, just for people who want to know?
So, when apartheid was in full swing, the government decided that you had black people, white people, and people in the middle who weren't black or white, and they called them coloured. Okay. And that community has been going for generations under that name, and it's no longer an insulting term in South Africa. It basically means mixed race.
This is the group that seemed to feature quite a bit in your feature. It was the coloured part of Cape Town, wasn't it?
Yes, Cape Town has a very large coloured community, and the areas that we were going into with the Metro Drug Unit, they were mostly covering those areas.
Hmm. Now, the police force, the police are investigating it. There were a number of white police officers there as well as black police officers. Has the police force changed, or was the police force always mixed, even during the old days of apartheid?
The police force was mostly white, 20 years ago. And there were a smaller amount of coloured policemen in Cape Town, and then black policemen in South Africa were marginalized into separate units and kind of used to betray their own people. Mm. It was a really horrific situation. But now the police force is much more integrated, and it just so happens that most of the drug unit squad are colored.
Okay.
And is the case that you highlighted now, is this a growing problem in Cape Town? Has this been a consistent problem? I mean, just exactly how big is the problem of drug use and the of drug sales and the whole drug business in Cape Town?
Right. One of the big problems that the Western Cape faces is a gang problem. And they're a handful of pretty large gangs, and their stock in trade are drugs and other kinds of gangsterism. And most of these dealers, if they're not independent, then they kick up to the gangs and kind of feeds up like most gang systems. And the gangs on the Cape Flats have been at war with each other for a number of years over territory. And that seems to be getting worse. So in fact, there's a dedicated gang unit in Cape Town as well. And they really do have their hands full. It's a very, very violent and dangerous job for them. Dealers are usually also users, and users are also often dealers. You know, you become a dealer to support your habit. But it gets worse when you've got this pressure of large gangs looking for new people to sell their wares.
You were with the police as they were going round at that time, weren't you?
Yes. The Metro unit, which is separate to the normal South African police, allowed me to tag along for a week or two and kind of see what they get up to.
Right, okay. And I mean, do you think what you saw, was that representative of what goes on in the drug scene in Cape Town?
I think what I saw was representative of the mid to low level drug industry in Cape Town. I think there's a whole nother side to it where you have high level dealers shipping large amounts of products and importing large amounts of products. And some of those dealers, I'm sure, live very well. But the people I saw live in abject poverty. Even the leaders of large gangs live in what your audience would consider abject poverty. So it's not a great business plan.
Yeah. Okay. So would you say that the people who are in this business, they're driven into it, I suppose, maybe like many other people in the drugs business? So you could argue that they're driven into it out of desperation. Is it somewhat a lifestyle choice? Is it the, as you said, the abject poverty that they're living in? Is that what has led them to where they are today?
Yeah, these low-level dealers are driven into it because they have no options. They live in abject poverty. They're undereducated, and so are their parents, unfortunately. There's a very high level of alcohol abuse, and that's the scenario that they find themselves in.
Okay, now in the piece itself, you mentioned the police, and they have a pretty tough attitude to the people, to the drug users and dealers that they're dealing with. And I just want to ask you a bit about that in terms of how you found the police and how they dealt with it. I suppose because the last time a lot of the world would have seen anything from international police was that video that went around of them dragging a man on the back of their van. So yeah. In recent times there hasn't been a whole lot of great publicity. What would you say about the South African police, the Metro unit and the Metro unit as opposed to the SAPS, the SAPS, and how they deal with this type of thing?
Well, the main South African police force has a bad reputation, and certainly they're good apples and they're bad apples. But they do have a bad reputation, and recently there was a terrible video footage where cops dragged someone to his death behind the police van. But the Metro unit is a separate unit that's funded by each individual city, not by the South African police. And they have a much higher morale. I think that they're paid better and they have slightly better equipment. And they certainly seem more determined to complete their jobs. What I found when I was traveling with them was that they do have a very hard attitude. And they're very tough, but I didn't see any abuse of people or rights going out the window when I was traveling with them. Of course, that may have been because I was there.
Yeah.
but the impression I got from the Metro unit was that they're very professional, very determined, and they have to be tough on people because when they show weakness, they could die. I was in the situation where we went into a house that was really just a shell, where there were dealers working, and you know, they lined them up against the wall and searched them, and the main dealer refused to do that and took his hands off the wall and stepped quite quickly towards one of the cops, and you know, the cop had to smack him down, and they told me afterwards, you know, you have to do that, you have to show them who's the alpha male. It's a very kind of base way of operating. You know, you're not going to negotiate with that person,
right?
Because you could die.
Yeah, and also in some of the photos that you've shown here, there's pit bulls, and pit bulls have been treated quite badly, so they're, well, not trained, but they're desperate enough to severely maim or even kill one of the police officers. So it's a pretty tough environment that they're going into.
Yeah, it's a very tough environment. There's very little kind of ethics and morality going on from the side of the gangsters. It was heartbreaking to see these little puppies that they get, and train them up by being abusive to them and train them to be quite vicious. Mm. And in fact, in that house where I went in with them, where they were searching for drugs and those pit bulls were inside, there were about six or seven quite dodgy looking men who were then searched and made to lie on the floor. And just inside were a little family, two kids and a mom, and she was cooking them dinner. And she didn't seem to mind too much. It was I was quite astounded that they were, you know, having their dinner.
This is just a normal day, just a normal run of events. And Matthew, was there any difficulty in you getting access to this? I mean, either in joining the police, and then when you're with the police and they were apprehending these criminals, was there anything, you know, possibly the criminals are in a different space at that time, the dealers are in a different space, but was there any kind of wondering, like, who is this guy and what's he doing here?
From the Metro side, they were fine with me tagging along, but a lot of them work undercover, so I agreed that I would not take pictures of their faces that were clear in focus if they were undercover. From the South African police side, they don't allow journalists to tag along with them or film operations unless they are kind of for show, which they sometimes do. If it's a normal operation, they don't want a journalist there. They're very nervous of journalists, and probably for good reason.
Download a podcast and catch up on your listening at near.ie.
Near FM.
For the best in metal and hard rock, plus an inside look at the Irish scene, tune into Livewire with me, Metal Maguire, every Saturday, 7 to 8:30. Don't believe it, but the betting that you will.
If you thought that environmental destruction, planet meltdown, and even Armageddon was just around the corner, well, you could very well be right. But together we can do something to halt the destruction of our environment. To find out the why and the wherefore and possible solutions to saving our environment, why not tune in to Enviro 3:30 in the afternoons every Monday, 90.3 FM, with myself, John Houghton.
Senior citizens calling, senior citizens calling. Our mission is to impart relevant information. Tune your wireless to 90.3 FM any Monday from 2:30 to 3:30. Near FM calling, Near FM calling.
I'm Wynn na Muike, Clor Gwelgid, I Craile, I Glahort Reisha Cuig, Gach Tronona, I Rith na Shachtana. Over, Politeacht, Cursi Raha, Sport, Pastel, Agus Ciao. Oglev, Ladini Archula, O Bolia Aclea, Hor Huig, Agus O Hempel na Tire. I'm Wynn na Muike, Gach Law, a written shachtane, a galahor thraish a kuik.
Shea Radio Pubble Tushkert, Balia Ohaclia,
your community station,
Near FM.
Welcome back to International Politics. I'm Peter Carney. I'm with you every Friday, fortnight, 6 to 7pm. The intervention by the Egyptian military to remove from office the first elected president in the country's long history and the brutal crackdown on those who protested against the military's return to the political arena seem to take Egypt into uncharted territory. In fact, we are witnessing the reassertion of long-standing political dynamics as the Egyptian armed forces seek to defend a structure of privileges and prerogatives which has developed since the military coup of 1952, which overthrew the monarchy and established the modern Republic of Egypt. So says Dr. Vincent Jurak, Middle Eastern Politics and Political Islam in the School of Politics and International Relations in UCD, which is where he lectures. That was in an article in the Irish Times going back a couple of weeks now. Well, since that time, and as is ongoing, there have been protests in Dublin and around the world against the actions of the Egyptian military in the what is yet to be officially called a military coup, but yet for all intents and purposes it has been a military coup. Egyptians in Dublin were protesting back on the 16th and 17th of August, and of course all of this was brought home to us by the fact that the Halawa siblings, the four siblings, Omeyma, Fatima, Sumaya, and their 17-year-old brother Ibrahim, who are the offspring of the imam in the Clonskee Mosque, who are currently being held captive. And as Mary Fitzgerald wrote in the Irish Times, that the four citizens were detained during the unrest, that no decision will be taken on their case until this weekend, although I believe an Irish representative, an Irish political representative, has seen them. So to find out more about it, or indeed to get the thoughts of Egyptians living in Ireland about what's happening in Egypt, I went along to the protests. These are taking place on the 16th and 17th of this month. They took place then. And I also have a short interview, an edited interview that I've already done with Vincent Jurak, Dr. Vincent Jurak, which will be featured in the upcoming radio documentary I'm making called Understanding Muslims in Ireland. So this is from the Egyptian protests.
To condemn what happened on the Black Wednesday before yesterday, killing civilians, protesters in the street, peaceful protesters, and breaking down the two squares in Rabaa al-Adawiya and Mahda in Giza by force, shooting from the sky by helicopters. Shooting by live bullets, okay. And from the ground.
And what are you doing here today?
We are making cars convoy in Dublin on the street to condemn this, and to be we are against, we are anti-coup, okay. And we are against the coup that happened in Egypt, and now they are killing in cold-blooded people around.
Would you see the current regime in Egypt as just a continuation of the Mubarak regime? What the regime that's just after getting rid of Morsi? It's a continuation of the Mubarak regime.
Yes. It's a continuation of the regime of military, the military regime. They couldn't take it 1 year away from the regime. They broke it back to come back again.
And who's behind this coup?
It's the military, Sisi, and the leaders with him.
And is it an attempt to put back either in Mubarak or Mubarak's people? Is it an attempt for them to put Mubarak?
No, they are covering themselves by some people they brought them, like this Adli Mansour, like this Prime Minister. They cover them, but they are the real control of Egypt now.
And there's
no more votes. Clean votes after that. Everything will be again falsified.
And do you think, is this something against the Muslim Brotherhood, or is it something against
No, not at all. This is the brotherhood phobia that they always say to all the world. This is brotherhood, we want to kill them now, to finish them now. But this is the Egyptian people, from Aswan up to Alexandria, from Arish to Marsa Matruh. All the Egyptian people, maybe you've seen the CNN, you see the all the news, this everywhere, people in the streets. Mm. How they can say this, they are certain, like the only people who how to eliminate this to only brotherhood. This is only it's a way to say that we're doing this because they are that, because they are a dangerous group.
And why is it that you think that the government of Morsi and the military couldn't work together? Why is it that the military felt the need to overthrow?
I tell you something, frankly. The Morsi, he wanted Egypt to have its world. He wants us to have our medicine, our wheat, our bread, and our weapon. And the United States, they don't want that. They want Egypt to follow them always for the safety of Israel.
Okay.
Yeah, the safety of Israel is number one.
So you think that American and Israeli interests are behind this government, this military coup in Egypt?
Yes, yes. It is against any Muslim countries in the world now. If you notice, the Western country living in peace, everything nice democratically. But when any Muslim country come to a democracy, no. Because when the Muslims start to upgrade themselves, be free from problems, start to build themselves, they can do it like the West. We are not less than the West. The Eastern people, the Muslim people also can do their country well. But now, what is going on since one or two centuries, don't let any Muslim country to have a free head to develop herself. You must make problems. After the imperialism withdrew from the Muslim countries, now there is another thing. We have our men to control these countries, and they take orders from us. So that's why Egypt is going down and down. You know, before the military revolution in 1952, the Egyptian pound could buy an English gold pound, and you have some pennies left. Now, the economy gone down because of the military regime. The military regime, they don't know how to rule the country. We vote, we choose Morsi. He's a professor in the university. He is a well-educated man, and he was very sincerely taken to free Egypt from following other countries and listening to the orders from other countries like states, United States, and Israel. And that's it. The problem is like this. The problem is like this. This army is taking money from United States since 35 years now, taking $1.5 billion almost every year. And this army, they don't want Morsi, because Morsi, he want to have a free Egypt. And they don't want that, otherwise they will gonna lose this 150 million. Sisi take every month £3 million salary for him from this 3 million. He doesn't want to lose all this, because we going to depend on ourselves, and our president, he was going to make Egypt depend on itself, produce food, medicine, weapons. So we don't need anybody, we don't need to depend on the United States. They don't want that. They want Egypt weak, because they want all the Arab countries around Israel to be weak. They did this with a plan to break first Iraq, because the Iraqi army was very strong, and then they are breaking the Syrian army now. And the other countries like Jordan, they are betrayers. These people are betrayers. But Egypt now is the strongest army now. They want to destroy this army as well. And they are making all these plots now. And I think also the states are behind this coup.
Very much.
Well, what brings us here today is the terrible massacre that was carried out in Egypt last week and is continuing. Over 600 people killed on Wednesday, according to the official figures, probably many more. And that killing is continuing. More than 60 were killed yesterday and so on.
Okay. And you're part of the Irish anti-war movement?
Yes, I'm on the steering committee of the Irish anti-war movement.
Okay, and what are you looking for now? What are you hoping happens next?
We want an end to the slaughter. We want to stop the killing. We want the Irish government to take strong action. We want the US to end military aid to the Egyptian military. Those are our main things that we want to see happen.
And who do you think is behind what's happening in Egypt at the moment?
You say the situation in Egypt at the moment is complicated, but behind it, in front of it is the question. In front of it is the military who long ruled Egypt, who are trying to re-establish their rule, and who are imposing a military dictatorship. Okay. This will not just affect the Muslim Brotherhood, this will affect all dissidents, all opposition, workers, trade unionists, revolutionaries in Egypt.
So I was just giving an overall summary of what's happening, really, and I was saying that it's a complete massacre from the army and the police forces, butchering the people. And the Egyptian media, which is 100% controlled by Mubarak and the old regime, they're claiming that those are terrorists and they are armed people. Well, simply, if you look at the situation, how could you have armed people on one side, yet all the casualties are from their side? We have more than 600 people who have died, and other statistics say that are actually almost 2,000 people. And we have injured people who are dying every day. On the other side, the army and the police forces, there is absolutely no casualties. Perhaps the media claims that there's a few policemen who have been injured, but this is not something that is going between two armies. This is simply people who don't have any weapons at all, and people who have all kinds of weapons, and they're butchering the other people. It's a complete massacre. And the people on the streets belong to different parties and different ideologies. They're not all about Islamists or so forth. They're different people, and they're all calling for one thing. We have to go back to democracy. This is not a way to change a president if he's not performing well. And when you compare the Morsi to the previous president, simply you have one who is not performing very well to one who has been oppressing and killing and torturing for many, many years. Second, this is not the way to change a president. In any democratic country, if you vote for a president and you think he's not performing very well, then you wait and then you vote for that other person in the next elections. This is simply how you change a president.
And what organization are you from yourself?
No, I'm a PhD student in computer science in Trinity College.
Okay.
And but are you, not a certain organization.
Are you a member of any organization in particular?
Not at all.
Okay,
not
great. At all. And who is here today? I mean, I can see Socialist Workers' Flags. Is there a coalition of different organizations, or are you aware?
Well, I'm not 100% aware of this. I'm a member of the Egyptian community, and I was notified that there's a protest here in front of the embassy today, and I think they also said that the Irish anti-war group will be here as well, so I'm here.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But I don't belong to any specific group other than being an Egyptian living in Ireland.
Okay, and from his time in power, Morsi, how much responsibility do you think lies with him and the Muslim Brotherhood for how they ran Egypt? Granted, they're only in power for a year and they were democratically elected, but how much responsibility is on them for how they managed Egypt during their time?
Good. I can say they had mistakes, but then let's face it, you're trying to face 30 or even 60 years of corruption and oppression. You're trying to face that in a year. So how could you judge them? I mean, they tried their best. And now we can see from the military coup that they did not have control over the police forces. They did not have control over the army forces. And how could you get anything done with the army and the police against you? Mm. And the media, which is 100% controlled by Mubarak's people, they're still feeding the people, feeding and brainwashing the people.
Still Mubarak that has his hand in this somewhere.
Certainly. You could watch the Egyptian media and you could watch any other news channel in the world and you would see that it's absolutely the opposite. The Egyptian media just keeps feeding, brainwashing people all the time.
And what contact, if any, have you had with the people in the mosque or the people in Egypt?
In the protests?
Yes.
I have very close friends in the protests, friends whom I've been in college with in Egypt, friends whom I've worked with in Egypt, friends who were actually here studying, doing PhDs as well, and they went back to Egypt after they finished their PhDs.
Have you spoken to them recently?
Yes, indeed. Over the phone, text messages, and sometimes speak to their families. And some of them...
What have they said to you about what's happening
now? They're in the protests. Number one, I asked them actually, hey, all the media is claiming that there are weapons inside. Can you please tell me the truth? Because those are friends I trust. I've been them with for years, you know. They absolutely assured me that there are no weapons inside. It's a massacre, which from the army and the police side. Mm. They are being tortured. The people, their friends dying beside them. They even try to bury them and they're prevented from that. It's horrible. I mean, and there's blood and crying everywhere.
Okay. And are there representatives, or are there different groups within the mosque and in the protests, or is it, I mean, are these ordinary Egyptians, or are they members of Muslim Brotherhood?
Again, no, certainly not members of the Muslim Brotherhood, because I know them personally, as I was saying. And whether a person belongs to the Muslim Brotherhood or not, it's really not an accusation, you know. Hmm. So, but then I know that they're not, but I'm just saying that it's not an accusation even if they were.
Okay. Protesters on the squares and streets of Cairo and all over the country. What's happening is a serious attempt to bring back the dictatorship of Hosni Mubarak. Hosni Mubarak did not fall down. We got the head of the regime, but the rest of the regime was still well established in the different institutions of the country, in the military, in the judiciary, in the security forces, in the media. what has happened recently and the ousting of President Mohamed Morsi was a plot that took long while enough to make sure that, you know, the Egyptian revolution is gone. It's an attempt to get rid of the gains and achievements of the Egyptian revolution of the 25th of January. We have to stand strongly against the restoration and return of dictatorship. I think the Egyptian people deserve freedom, deserve equality, deserve a future, deserve a democracy. We have a great nation, but a bunch of dictators, a bunch of criminals want to hijack our freedom, our democracy, our rights, and our future. And I blame the international community, including the Irish government, for keeping quiet and silent in the face of atrocities and massacres that have taken place so far.
I'm here to show support with the Egyptian people. I went to school with Umaima and in primary school and secondary school, so I'm here to stand with her and her siblings to show support, to show unity.
It's Umaima who's in the mosque in Cairo at the moment.
Yeah, she's her and her two sisters and her brother are trapped in the mosque at the moment. I'm here to just show my unity and to stand with them and to show that we do care and to let them know that although physically we can't be there with them, we're here with them in spirit and we're here to just support them and give them power and let them know that we care here in Ireland. We might be miles away, but we care and that we haven't stopped caring.
Okay, and what contact have you had with her, if any, recently?
I spoke to her before she left. I remember speaking to her, but I've seen her, I have her on Facebook. She's been updating things on Facebook, but recently it's gone kind of quiet. So I've been relying on information from other people from the Muslim community. So we have a page on Facebook and they write up everything that's going on. So they've like updated me by telling me like they're trapped, or I spoke to Umaima, I spoke to Ibrahim. So
what's that page on
it's
Facebook?
It's the Muslim Youth Ireland page.
Muslim Youth Ireland.
Yeah,
okay,
so it's very good. So everybody shares any information that they have. And it's just a nice way to kind of show support and unity so we all know exactly what's going on.
And from what you hear of what's going on, where do you see it going from here?
Like, to be honest, I think it has escalated. And from now, I don't want to be pessimistic, but I just see bloodshed. I mean, it's just, I see that the military and CC supporters, they're only seeing it with one road. They're, you know, it's either you come out and you surrender or you're going to die. Mm. And those two choices, you know what I mean? Like, they're not feasible choices to step by. So for me, I kind of feel there's going to be another bloodshed. I hope that there isn't, but I'm scared for Maima and her siblings, and I hope, and for the rest of the Egyptian people, that I mean, that they can get out of this safely. Maybe foreign aid can come in and we can come to some peace talks or something, or even for a week of peace,
yes,
just to get everybody back together and allow them to grieve.
And for you, is this a continuation of what we call the Arab Spring? Is this the Arab Spring still going on?
I think it is the Arab Spring still going on. And I think now, because it's been going on for a while, and I think we're all aware of each other. So each Muslim country, we're all standing together, you know. So, I mean, I'm an Algerian nationality, but I'm here standing with the Egyptians.
Hey.
You know, last year I stood with the Libyans. So we're all Muslims. We're here united. So now we're just trying to stand together regardless of nationality.
And
so
to were us, you born here in Ireland?
No. I was born and raised in Algeria for 7 years. And then I moved to Ireland and I study here at the moment.
Very good. And that's just a sample of some of the voices that I picked up at the protest back on the 16th and 17th of August. And as you know, the situation is still ongoing. And indeed, as well, as I was saying at the start, according to Mary Fitzgerald's column in the Irish, a piece in the Irish Times today, the decision on the lab has yet to be made and they're still in custody in Egypt. As well as that, as I said, I'm making a radio documentary of Muslims in Ireland. And as part of that, and also in conjunction with what's happening in Egypt, I caught up with Dr. Vincent Jurek of UCD, who is knows quite a lot about the area. He's a lecturer in Middle Eastern politics and political Islam in the School of Politics and International Relations in UCD. And this is what Vincent Jurek had to say about his take on what's happening in Egypt.
You see, what so far seems to be little or no change. Can we really believe that it's the ordinary members of the public who decided that, look, we've had enough of this and we're going to change things? Particularly after what we've seen in Egypt, we've seen the citizens take to the street, put in a new leader, democratically elect a new leader, and then the army moves in. Can we really believe that it's the ordinary citizens who are behind these revolutions, movements?
Yeah, I mean, I think we can. The question is what happens next. I mean, you know, certainly in Tunisia, in Egypt, in in Yemen and I think in Syria as well. Libya is slightly different. I think regional competition, if you like, and regional grievance played a greater role in the Libyan case. But in the other four countries, I think you can say for sure that what he had, at least in the early stages of the revolts, was mass mobilisation. What he had was a wide coalition of actors, of social actors, whose grievance, whose concerns found expression nowhere else, and they came together. But in turn, what you had was largely leaderless movements. Mm. So revolutionary coalitions, as they often are, with a single aim to overthrow the regime, but with very little agreement between them on what else to do, on what the post-revolutionary, as it were, order might look like. And that, in the case of Tunisia, has resulted, I think, in genuine cross-ideological cooperation, if you want to call it that. The jury is still out, but the Tunisians are certainly taking much greater care and taking much longer to try to craft a new order in the country. But there's a crucial factor there, which is that the army had no stake in the economic or political life of the country. So the army was and remains a more or less neutral actor in a way that is not the case in any of the other countries we're talking about, save in Libya, where there really wasn't an army, there are lots of militias. In the Egyptian case, very quickly, the old guard took advantage of the situation. The military deposed their former colleague and collaborator, Hosni Mubarak, and in my personal opinion, since February 2011, the military has, to a significant extent, dictated the pace and the nature of change in the country ever since. To the extent that the presidential election was manipulated, the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces effectively decided who might and might not go for election, effectively vetoed candidates from the Muslim Brotherhood who were more popular than Mohamed Morsi and more able, one might argue. And very successfully conspired to produce an outcome in which one of their own, Ahmed Shafiq, was in the runoff against a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. Two elements in Egyptian society that either were the object of suspicion or, in the case of the Brotherhood, played a surprisingly limited role in the early days of the revolutionary anti-regime movement. So, yes, these protests or uprisings constituted an attempt on the part of the mass of the population, or very many of the population, to put an end to the old order. But in being inchoate and being incoherent, in being, I've argued elsewhere in a paper that I wrote that the very nature of these movements, being leaderless, being largely lacking in ideological coherence, being non-traditional in their forms of organisation, mobilisation and communication, all of these things allowed them to evade conventional surveillance. You had to step back in.
And is that, yes, was that an opportunity that allowed the Egyptian army back in, or was this something that was fiendishly plotted right from the start? It was kind of like, well, we know these guys aren't going to get anywhere. Let's just let it play out until the moment's right.
In the case of Egypt, I think the military has always been keeping a very close eye on events, and the military has a very significant stake in the economic as well as the political life of the country. But also, I think many in the military do see themselves as the guardians of the national interest. It's married, of course, to the fact that they have this economic stake, but we can all persuade ourselves the things that are in our best interest happen to be in the interest of the greater good as well. What a coincidence, how wonderful that is, that you're doing something for Egypt that happens to bolster your own position. But from get-go, from very early on, I mean, from the moment that Field Marshal Tantawi, the then Chief of Staff, announced that in the interests of the country, Hosni Mubarak was stepping down, being stepped down, and the Supreme Council for the Armed Forces was going to safeguard the interests of the country, that evening, I called it as a military coup.
Yes.
And that's what it was. In the Yemeni case, things are more complicated, but nonetheless, from a very, very early point, the dominant coalition of opposition parties and the old regime battled it out, as it were, over the heads of the youth protesters, who are very articulate, who are relatively well organised, but who've been excluded from the, even from the negotiations on post Saleh, Ali Abdullah Saleh, the long term president.
The 12 months or so that Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood were in power, their political wing was in power, is it a case that they couldn't get control, or they couldn't get a hold of what was really controlling Egypt, such as the military, or were they not allowed to get control of it?
There was never any prospect of the Muslim Brotherhood getting control of the military, and the best they could hope for was to come to some modus vivendi, which they certainly tried to do. I mean, Morsi and his government, which was not exclusively a government of Islamists, I think it's worth remembering. We tend to assume that every minister was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, not the case, nor indeed, of course, were the Brotherhood capable of Islamizing the entire public service in a year, even though they probably would have liked to. But the new government was in many respects disastrous. It followed the exclusionary pattern of politics under Mubarak. The assumption that with a plurality but not a majority of the votes, with the biggest share of the seats in Parliament but nothing like 50% of the total valid poll, as it were, that the Brotherhood could pretty much do whatever they liked. That was one of the great miscalculations, the failure to make serious allies across the political spectrum. And indeed, the ultimately very, very self-defeating calculation that they could come to terms with the military. And what has happened throughout Egyptian history since 1952 is that the military, in various guises, has, when it suited them, cooperated with the Islamists. When threatened by the Islamists, have crushed them.
Right.
And business has resumed as usual. It happened within 2 years of the free officers coming to power in 1954. It happened in 1963. It happened under Sadat for a few years. It happened in the early years of Mubarak's presidency. And every time the Brotherhood posed a threat to the regime or to the interests of the military, they were suppressed. So it's not remotely surprising that the same thing is happening today. And let's not forget that the Brotherhood have, despite what many people might think, have abjured violence. You know, they've been complicit in very nasty violence over the last year, and particularly in recent weeks. But for the most part, this is a non-violent organisation. Albeit that offshoots have engaged in violence, but offshoots of the organisation that have been expressly rejected and censured by the leadership with a great deal of consistency since, say, the 1970s.
Okay.
So they were never going to be in a position to take on the military. They don't have the capacity to do that.
Okay.
But it became clear very quickly that Mohamed Morsi was not, and the Muslim Brotherhood were not, going to do anything significantly to alter underlying patterns in relation to Egyptian dealings with either with Israel or with Gaza. And it was the Muslim Brotherhood government that most actively filled the tunnels, for instance, through which so many Gazans derive sustenance. It was the Muslim Brotherhood who imposed ever greater restrictions on the crossing at Rafah, the one land crossing into Gaza that the Egyptians control.
Some people might have seen it, but look, this is our opportunity to get rid of Israel and get freedom for the Palestinians.
For all sorts of reasons, economic and geopolitical, the Egyptians didn't want to do anything to rock the boat on Gaza. They could have opened the border at Rafah and said, come and live with us in Egypt, and we'll have another 1 million poor Palestinians. But the lot of pre-existing Palestinian refugee populations in Egypt is not a happy one. I mean, historically, Palestinian refugees in Syria, in Lebanon, and in Jordan even, have been treated much better than the Egyptians have treated their Palestinians. There's very little focus or attention paid to this, but it happens to be the case. But more significantly because Morsi, while trying to entrench his position within Egypt, while trying to play tic-tac-toe with the military, was also trying to assure the Americans that he wouldn't do